$92 a month if they move to work in Bangalore, down from their $1,500 a month salary in France. Workers in Bangalore also put in a six-day work week. The company also offered its workers a free plane ticket and a 1,000 euro bonus for leaving, but no one is expected to accept the offer. Union leaders greeted the proposition with a mixture of anger and stupefaction. The factory boss himself called the offer stupid, but said he was obligated to propose it under French law. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
Fire crews in Southern California are digging containment lines around the wildfire that has destroyed at least 77 homes in Santa Barbara County. The blaze is now about 65% contained. Thousands of residents of the area who had been evacuated were allowed to return to their homes over the weekend. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from AMARC Foundation, supporting ProCon.org, a website designed to help teachers and the public explore the pros and cons of controversial issues.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. On the Monday edition of Live and Local, we'll have a conversation with Milton Scott, director of the choral group Opus 24, about their upcoming concert in Decatur. Milt will be joined by pianist Jackson Berkey of Mannheim Steamroller and his singer and lyricist wife, Almeida. Both will be guests with Opus 24. It's Live and Local, your connection to local music, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us for hour number two of the show. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. Since the early 1980s, the Tamil Tigers have been fighting to establish an independent state in the north of Sri Lanka. It now appears that dream is almost over, ended by the imminent military defeat of the Tigers by Sri Lankan government troops. Many questions, however, remain. Questions about the future of the country's Tamil minority and also about the ability of the Tigers to continue in one form or another their armed struggle. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some about the present and perhaps also the future of Sri Lanka. And our guest for the program is John Richardson. He's professor of international development at American University's School of International Service. He also directs the AU's Center for Teaching Excellence. For many years, he was director of the Sri Lanka-based International Center for Ethnic Studies. He is also affiliated with several other Sri Lanka-based organizations. He's been visiting and writing about Sri Lanka for more than 20 years. In the late 80s, he was a visiting professor of history and political science at University of Colombo and continues to lecture regularly at the university and other Sri Lankan venues. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. And that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions welcome. All we ask of callers is people are brief in their comments and questions, so we can keep moving along. But, of course, callers are welcome. Professor Richardson, hello.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. We certainly want to spend some time talking about the background of this conflict, but what I'd like to do is to start where we are right now to the extent that we can talk about that. For some time now, people have been reading these stories about what seems to be the end of the armed struggle, or at least an important phase of the armed struggle between the Tamil Tigers and the government, with the Tigers holding on to a tiny piece of land and under attack from the government, and with tens of thousands of civilians caught in between the two forces. A lot of people have been killed. The Tigers and the government blame each other. It's difficult to know what's going on there because the government won't let any reporters go there to see. If, to the best of your knowledge, with the kind of information sources that you have and what you've read, can you say something about where things stand right now?
Well, I think you've given a pretty good summary. As you say, almost every statement of fact is disputed by one side or the other, and the government has not only prescribed access to the combat area, but also expelled reporters posting stories and pictures that are viewed as unfavorable to them. The area in which the LTTE forces have been pushed, they say, is not much larger than New York's Central Park. Much of this has been designated by the government as a no-fire zone, but there are a lot of reports that say there is substantial firing. In addition to the fighters, there are, as you've said, large numbers of civilians. Some describe them as LTTE supporters who have voluntarily fled the government advances, and others say they're captives who are being held against their will by the Tigers, even used as human shields. In addition to that, there are large numbers of refugees who have successfully fled the fighting, and they're mostly being held in internment camps a little bit to the west of the area where the fighting's going on. Possibly some of these are Tiger sympathizers, and the conditions under which they're being held and how they're being treated is, again, a matter of dispute. I think outside the Tamil-majority regions, the government has widespread support, especially inside the capital city. President Rajapakse, a few months ago, made an eloquent speech to the United Nations in which he spoke both in Sinhalese, which is the majority language, and Tamil, the minority language, and called for reconciliation. However, in the capital city, the symbols of Sinhalese nationalism are very, very visible, and those are the symbols that you see and hear about when the military victories are described. So it's a typical situation where a government is facing a militant movement and trying to build nationalist support among those who support them under somewhat difficult circumstances.
Mm. Certainly, the people around the world, various international human rights organizations and the United Nations have called for a ceasefire. They said, look, at the very least, we need to do something about to help these civilians who mostly are noncombatants and aren't involved, at least to get out of the way. And it seems that the government of Sri Lanka just doesn't seem particularly interested.
Well, there's a lot of history there. The government would respond that in the past there have been peace agreements, peace negotiations. The Norwegian facilitators were involved in an agreement that began in 2002, and every time the LTTE, the government spokespersons and leaders would say, have used this as an opportunity to build up support. They have a strong international propaganda operation. And basically, I think President Rajapakse's government and the chief of the army staff, General Fonseca, have said, this is a chance for a military victory. In the long run, they would argue the Tamil people are going to be better off if they are not under the control of the Tigers, and they're going to fight to the finish. What's really happening in terms of the human rights situation is difficult to determine because there has been little access, and the government takes the position that many who are pointing out human rights violations and the suffering of people, alleged suffering in the no-fire zone, or have become either witting or unwitting instruments of LTTE propaganda. Probably what's actually happening is somewhere in between those two positions, but the positions are so polarized that it's difficult to really know for sure.
Let's go back and to talk a little bit about Sri Lanka. This is Sri Lanka is an island. It's off the coast of India. It's a place that at one time was known as Ceylon.
Right.
It became independent at about the same time, shortly after India and Pakistan became independent.
Has 1948.
Some, 1948
yeah.
Has some important ties. Culturally speaking, at least the Tamil minority has important cultural ties to India,
right?
And which has complicated things over the years. We can talk about that. But how did things stand at the time of independence between the Tamil minority and the Sinhalese majority population of the island?
It was a fairly typical post-colonial situation. But with some differences. I mean, Sri Lanka had been a functioning democracy to a significant degree since 1935, and I think most people would say that at the time of independence, the communal relations between the majority and the minority community were fairly harmonious. On the one hand, the Sinhalese would say that under British colonialism, the Tamils had been given preferential treatment. The Tamils would say that as soon as Sri Lanka became democratic, then the Sinhalese began using their democratic majority to begin either redressing past grievances or gaining preferential treatment for their ethnic group. But until really the 1950s, ethnic tensions were, tensions between the two groups were not all that visible. Then in 1956, you had an election in which the party of Prime Minister Bandaranaike instituted an official language policy in which the language of the majority, the Sinhalese language, Sinhala language, became the official language, and many people point to that as the beginning of real communal differences. Nonetheless, really, by many up through the 1970s, Sri Lanka was viewed as one of the most notable development success stories, both in terms of the performance of its economy and especially in the area of human well-being. And most people who lived in the country during that period, I did not, describe it as a relatively peaceable, harmonious place. And just one last thing, I mean, even at the present time, many, many Tamils live in the Sinhalese majority areas and are active in business and in religion and in education and so forth. So throughout this conflict, Tamils and Sinhalese have gotten along pretty well, although now I think it's particularly difficult for Tamils, given the fact that the Sinhalese nationalism has been identified with military success, and some Sinhalese at least view every Tamil-speaking person as a potential terrorist, which of course is not the case.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is John Richardson. He's professor of international development at American University's School of International Service. He also directs the AU Center for Teaching Excellence. For a long time, he was director of the Sri Lanka-based International Center for Ethnic Studies and has been visiting and writing about Sri Lanka for more than 20 years. That's what we're talking about here this morning, trying to talk about a little bit about recent developments there and this long-running now, at least over more than 20 years, a battle between the government and the Tamil Tigers.
Yeah, Dave, I should say I'm a director, was a director of the International Center, an international director, and they also had a local director as well.
Right.
Make sure I don't exaggerate my role.
Very good. Questions are welcome from people listening to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you know, given that, that there was this history that you talked about, that the Sinhalese and the Tamils managed to live together fairly well, even though there might indeed have been some grievances about Tamil rights going back to the colonial and the post-colonial times, something clearly happened in the early 1980s for things to turn violent and for the fighting, really serious fighting, to begin between the Tigers and the government. Was there something in particular that happened around that time that escalated things?
There absolutely was. There was a pivotal month. Some people call it Black July in 1983, when a patrol in the north of Sri Lanka was ambushed by the LTTE, and the bodies were brought back to Colombo. And to make a long story short, this precipitated rioting in the city of Colombo and then elsewhere in the country. As a consequence of that rioting, a significant number of Tamils, several hundred, maybe more, were killed, and more than 100 were made refugees. And these were people who were by no means LTTE or militant supporters. There were a number of militant groups then. And as a consequence of that, there was a lot of support generated for the LTTE, both in, or for various militant groups, both in Tamil Nadu state, which is a Tamil majority state in India, and also by the Indian government. The Indian government set up training camps, and young men who had become refugees flocked to the banners of various militant groups. So these events transformed a situation where you had political grievances into a situation where suddenly you had constituted, as a result of the policies of the Sri Lankan government and the way they dealt with the riots, and whether they were complicit in them is a matter of dispute. But in any case, suddenly you had organized militant movements, you had lots of young men flocking to their banners, you had training camps and sanctuaries in India, and that fundamentally changed the character of the conflict. I mean, what's true about these chronic, persistent conflicts is that while when they begin, it may be because of, in this case, political and economic grievances, but then it becomes not a spontaneous movement, but a highly organized movement. And, of course, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, which became the dominant movement, partly because of their effectiveness and partly because the leadership had the opponents of the LTTE, the Tamil militant opponents, killed off. became one of the most dominant and effective, I mean, one of the most effective militant movements in the world.
Yeah. It seems to me that's a key point in the kind of things that we've seen, as you say, we've seen in other conflicts.
Sure.
Other places where you may have a kind of opposition sort of movement that's actually made up of different sorts of groups that may have slightly different aims, or at least that they may be may have different ideas about to what extent they want to use force.
Sure.
And that over time, maybe one group, maybe the hardest, the one that's most dedicated to armed struggle, ends up becoming dominant. And in part, as you say here, and it's happened other places, essentially because they've eliminated other groups that compete with them, and that then you get to the point where perhaps you get then you end up with a group that's simply not amenable to negotiation, and who sees really the armed struggle as being the only way to get where it is that they want to go.
Yeah, it doesn't always happen that way. So you can think of examples. You know, in South Africa, you had a Nelson Mandela who was emerged as the leader. And, you know, in other countries, I mean, there were tensions, although not fighting, between Singapore and Malaysia, and that became a kind of velvet divorce. In some cases, you have had leaders after a struggle who have made the transition from becoming military leaders to becoming civilian leaders, although often with fairly authoritarian regimes. For example, in Eritrea, in Vietnam, I suppose you could say also in China. But that did not happen in Sri Lanka. I mean, even in Sri Lanka, interestingly, people are not aware of this, but there was not only a civil war in the north, there was a civil war in the south led by a group called the JVP, which are the Sinhala initials for the People's Liberation Front. And the JVP is now a legitimate, accepted political party in Sri Lanka that's become very much part of the mainstream. But attempts to have that happen with the LTTE through a whole series of negotiations never succeeded, and that has been, it seems to me, a tragic outcome not only for Sri Lanka, the Sri Lankan nation, the Sri Lankan country, but especially perhaps the Tamil people themselves have been the biggest losers.
How did the Indian support for the LTTE, the Tamil Tigers, how did that affect official relations between the governments of India and Sri Lanka?
It created problems. The support, the strong support for the LTTE was in part, India sees itself as a hegemon in the South Asian area. There were strained relationships between Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, who was the Prime Minister at the time, and the Sri Lankan President at the time the riots broke out, J.R. Jayawardene. The fact that you have Tamil Nadu state being a very important state in Indian internal politics complicates matters. So for a period of time, when the Sri Lankan government was following a somewhat independent path from India, both geopolitically and personally, it became in the interest of the Indian central government and the Indian intelligence services to support Tamil militancy. Of course, and this was this kind of, I would say, error in judgment that has characterized the Tamil militant leader Vilupalai Prabhakaran. Prabhakaran assassinated Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi assassinated, and that changed the picture very, very significantly. And after the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi by actually a woman suicide bomber in 1991. Then it became much more difficult for India to support the LTTE. Mm-hmm. And of course, earlier the Indians had sent a peacekeeping force to Sri Lanka. I was there when that happened, living in Sri Lanka, and that force became bogged down and. The Sri Lanka intervention on India's part became kind of like India's Vietnam.
We have a caller here. I want to get to them, someone who is on a cell phone. So we'll go right there. Line number one.
Sure.
Hello.
Hi. You've just began answering the question which I'm interested in, which is talking about both the support of India for the Tamil Tigers, but also the support of the Tamil, let's call it diaspora, especially the financial support and also the support in bringing in weapons of all sorts, aircraft, ships, et cetera, which in a sense has exacerbated the violence and escalated the violence. So I wondered if you would talk about the outside influences that supported and made possible the Tamil Tigers and who else they had links with besides people in Tamil Nadu and people in the West who were of Tamil origin or at least supported them. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thanks for the comments.
Sure. There is an extensive Tamil diaspora, a large and number, talented in their accomplishments, many of them very well-to-do attorneys and doctors and university professors and business people in Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the like, and they have either knowingly or through front organizations or some would argue as a result of extortion provided extensive funding to the LTTE. And so this has been a significant consideration, and the LTTE has had a very widespread and effective external organization. Some argue, the Sri Lankan government certainly argues, that this has involved weapons sales, the weapons business, not only for their own income but in support of other groups. And allegations have been made that they've been involved in the sale of illegal drugs as well. But I think to give a brief answer, there has been voluntary support by the Tamil diaspora, and in addition to that, there has been support that's been gained by means other than voluntary and also illegal.
We are just a bit past our midpoint here. Let me take a moment to introduce once again our guest. John Richardson is professor of international development at American University's School of International Service. For many years, he was a director of the Sri Lanka-based International Center for Ethnic Studies. He's also affiliated with several other Sri Lanka-based organizations. He's been visiting and writing about Sri Lanka for more than 20 years. In the late 80s, he was visiting professor of history and political science at the University of Colombo and continues to lecture often at the university and other Sri Lankan venues. We're talking about recent events there in Sri Lanka. Questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, I would just wonder if we go back for a moment to the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi, which you talked about a little bit. And I still, I guess I find myself not quite understanding why, given the fact that the Indian government had this long-standing policy of support for the Tigers, why it is that then the Tigers should decide that Rajiv Gandhi should be assassinated and, in fact, send someone over to India to do that at a time when he was campaigning in the state of Tamil Nadu and as you say, was killed by a woman suicide bomber. Why did the leadership of the Tigers decide to do this?
Well, the Indian army came. Rajiv Gandhi believed that he could constitute himself as a mediator between the LTTE and the Sri Lankan government, and the agreement that he negotiated with the Sri Lankan government was not, which involved devolution of power, but the Indian government did not want an independent Tamil state in Sri Lanka, because of course separatism along ethnic lines has been a huge constitutional issue in India as well. So the Indians sent a relatively ill-prepared peacekeeping force to Sri Lanka. And initially, they were welcomed by the LTTE and welcomed by the Tamil people. But when Prabhakaran, you and the other LTTE leadership, but the LTTE is really led by one very, very dominant man, Mr. Prabhakaran, when he felt that the Indians had reneged on their agreement, then, in fact, the LTTE and the Indians became adversaries. And the Indians, the Indian army, attempted for several years, some would say not always with untied hands, attempted to defeat the LTTE and impose a military solution. That really explains it. So even though the peacekeeping force was welcomed as LTTE supporters, at least in some degree, then they became adversaries, and the Indian peacekeeping force actually fought the LTTE. And was seen by the LTTE as allied with the Sri Lankan government. So, for example, when you traveled to Jaffna, which was then the Tamil city in the north, in the late 1980s, Sri Lankan police officers and Indian army men would be working together, manning checkpoints, and really, the Indian army became, in a somewhat complicated way, but basically perceived by the LTTE as allied with the Sri Lankan government, and that's the reason that I can't look into Velapalai Prabhakaran's head, but I would say that became the consideration that that led him to target Rajiv Gandhi for assassination.
All right, let's talk with another caller here, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm wondering, you haven't really said much about the American involvement, I mean, our U.S. government, and if we weighed in on the side, on one or other side, not, I mean, within the, say, for the Sri Lankan government itself, between the different political parties that vie for elections there, and also the possible influence of the industry in Sri Lanka. I know it's another one of these countries where a lot of clothing manufacturers have located, and you know, I get clothes which say made in Sri Lanka a lot.
Sure.
Could you say something about the U.S. Involvement and interest in what goes on in Sri Lankan politics, not necessarily related to the Tamil conflict?
Sure. The I think, I mean, Sri Lankans, when I go to, since I live in Washington and visit Sri Lanka often, and Sri Lankans say, well, what are people thinking about Sri Lanka in Washington? And in general, Sri Lanka is fairly low on the political radar screen. But what you say is true. I mean, I think the Sri Lanka's governments have oscillated between a more free market-oriented government, the United Nationalist Party, and more business-friendly, and the present government, the Sri Lanka Freedom Party, or the People's Alliance, as it's now called. The U.S. has, to some degree, I think, been a little more supportive of the UNP governments because it's been easier to build and promote business relationships when they've been in power. But now I would say that both governments are more free market leaning. Most recently, of course, Sri Lanka has been concerned about not only the U.S., but also European governments protesting what are seen by these governments as human rights violations, and have actually been looking for support anywhere they can get it, which has included now overtures to Russia and to Iran and to Saudi Arabia, I believe, as well. The other thing is to say is that the Sri Lankan government has been quite successful in picturing itself as allied with the U.S. government in the war on terrorism. Now, I use the word militants to describe the LTTE rather than terrorists, although I certainly would say they have used terrorist tactics. But the Sri Lankan government has been unequivocal in labeling the LTTE terrorists and saying that they do not in any sense represent the will of the Tamil people. So, of course, in a war situation, let me say this. I mean, there has, under the multi-fiber agreement, a lot of Sri Lankan businesses prospered, and there has been support for U.S. Business interests in Sri Lanka. But I wouldn't, and as you say, garments have been manufactured in Sri Lanka and shipped to the U.S., a fairly typical kind of thing with young women working in factories. But I wouldn't say that Sri Lanka has been a priority U.S. concern, and obviously it's not a high priority concern of President Obama's administration at the moment either.
Did we have a particular interest or attitude toward the Kumaratunga government, which was, I think, back in the 90s?
We worked with the Kumaratunga government. We had a very effective ambassador. Sean Donnelly was the ambassador for much of the period of time, and he is now, I think, Assistant Secretary for Economic Affairs. So the policy of the U.S. government has been to promote opportunities for business, to promote reconciliation between the Sri Lankan government and the LTTE when peace negotiations were in progress, and certainly there were contacts, strong contacts. I mean, visits by the Assistant Secretary of State for South Asian Affairs, Secretary Indefer, I think, during that period. And so, yes, there definitely were during the Kumaratunga period, but subsequently as well.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more, this part of Focus 580. Our guest is John Richardson. He's professor of international development at American University's School of International Service and has someone who has been visiting and writing about Sri Lanka for now more than 20 years. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit at the beginning about where things stand now and the fact that the military forces of the Sri Lankan government have essentially pushed the Tigers to the point where they're just holding on to a tiny scrap of land, and it looks as if what we're looking at here is the, in one sense, the end of the Tigers, at least their major military defeat. At the same time, I'm sure that there still will be some sympathy for the Tigers and some ability for them to use violence in some form to, in a sense, to continue this struggle. So that leads to questions about, well, if indeed we have a military defeat for the Tigers, don't we expect the Tigers in some form to still exist and to still be posing a challenge to the Sri Lankan government for who knows how long?
Well, I think I think the answer is yes, but a really critical question will be the fate of the Tiger leader, Vilupalai Prabhakaran, whether it certainly is a goal of the Sri Lankan government to capture or kill the Tiger leader, and if they succeed in doing that, either killing him or cornering him, and he has said, like all the core LTTE group, he wears a suicide cyanide capsule around his neck, that he would never would be taken alive. If he survives, then is able to escape from the safe zone, assuming that he's there. Escaping to India, you see, would be difficult because of the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi. But if he is able to find his way into the jungle and continue his leadership, then I would say the likelihood that the Tigers will persist as a movement, a militant movement functioning as guerrillas, is more probable. If not, it seems to me more likely that you might have it fade away as a really effective movement, and really there might be a hope for a move toward reconciliation. I mean, my hope, Sri Lanka is a Buddhist country, and principles of Buddhism are to help other people, and if not that, to do no harm. This is the Buddhist principle of morality, and I am hopeful, and there is this strain in President Rajapaksa's statement, some of them, that that Sri Lanka, as a Buddhist country, you following what the government would call a military solution, could reach out and, as a Buddhist country, become then a model for communal reconciliation. As somebody who cares about Sri Lanka and has many friends there, both Sinhalese and Tamil, that's my hope and my prayer.
Well, would there be people within the government of Sri Lanka who might also say, look, that it is the case that that Tamils have some grievances and that something really ought to be done to address them?
Absolutely. I mean, there are many, many people, who believe this. And it's just like in the United States, where you get polarization around the war on, a war on terror. It's very hard. I mean, dissenting voices for government policy, whatever the policy is, in time of conflict, are given short shrift, and dissent can be viewed as unpatriotic. At the moment, that's happening in Sri Lanka, but I think President Rajapaksa has the potential, and there are other Sri Lankan leaders who have the potential to reach out once the conflict has ended. It would be in everybody's interest to take really decisive steps toward reconciliation based on Buddhist principles, I would argue, because that's the way the president has framed it. And that would be in the interest of all communities in Sri Lanka to transform this beautiful country into, once again, what it was once known for, which is a development success story.
Well, that's, I guess, that there is the question about what, through these years of fighting, particularly, the last 25 years, what that's done to the country, what has been lost, people who have been in, who would have been important in developing the country's economy, how many of them have left, how it has affected the image of Sri Lanka around the world. And even if you come to a point where you can say the war, essentially the war is over and it's time for rebuilding to occur, how long would it take to try to recover?
Well, the impacts have been devastating, of course. There's been, there have been direct costs. I mean, huge number of the most talented people have left the country. We've talked about the social cleavages and lost opportunities, but it seems to me the Sri Lankan diaspora, both Sinhalese and Tamil, is a rich resource. And if there were circumstances where there was real reconciliation and real opportunity, I think it's possible that that this resource could be drawn upon, that many talented Sri Lankans might return to the country, and that others who have worked in the country, you might donate resources and time. I mean, every time there have been positive steps toward reconciliation, you have seen a kind of flowering of travel between the North and South, and the recognition that that Tamils and Sinhalese could function effectively together. So if the government is willing not to build its future political support on polarization along nationalist lines, but on reconciliation, I think in a matter of 2 or 3 or 4 years, you could see a remarkable a remarkable transformation in Sri Lanka. It's a country with such great potential, and as I say, the possibility to build on Buddhist traditions, even though, of course, there is a militant strain of Buddhism in Sri Lanka as well, a fundamentalist strain, one might say, just as there are in other countries. So I am very hopeful about the possibilities for Sri Lanka.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have one more caller. At least we'll try to get in. This is someone who is listening in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes. I think it's somewhat misleading to say that the Rajapaksa brothers are motivated by the teachings of Gautama Buddha. In fact, the Buddhists I've dealt with over the years say that that the Buddhists in Sri Lanka just don't get it and don't understand it. The Buddhist monks and the Buddhist monasteries are the most violent, bigoted, and racist people you could possibly imagine. And there's even scholarly literature on this. It's sort of like the Zen Buddhists in Japan during World War II, encouraging Japanese militarism. As for the future, certainly, and Rajapaksa and his brother just exterminated 1,200 Tamils over the weekend with an artillery barrage on the so-called safe zone, that even the British Foreign Minister Miliband today just condemned at the UN, and the UN condemned it too, pointing out they just exterminated 100 children. I think that if, in fact, this does go forward and the tigers fall in Vani, that will certainly not be the end of it. They will continue guerrilla warfare, which they had specialized in for many years. And the extermination of the Tamils and Vani right now is simply mobilizing more support for the Tigers, not only in Sri Lanka, but also in the diaspora. So I think what needs to be done now is we need an immediate ceasefire imposed on Rajapaksa by the UN Security Council, by the United States government, by the British, massive provision of humanitarian assistance to the 200,000 Tamils in Vani, and then to resume the peace negotiations, which, by the way, were terminated by the Rajapaksa brothers, and to reinvolve Norway, whose services were also terminated by the Rajapaksa brothers.
I can give you, unfortunately, I can only give you about 30 seconds if you'd like to make some kind of response.
Well, I think that I think that is a point of view held by many, and I'm aware, I know a lot about Sri Lankan Buddhism, and there are certainly elements of what the caller has described, but I prefer to see the glass as half full rather than half empty. And I do believe that Sri Lankans need to resolve their own problems with as little outside intervention as possible, simply because outside intervention has not been a great success, and I don't think there's a will to take it seriously.
Our guest John Richardson is Professor of International Development at American University School of International Service. Professor Richardson, thank you very much.
Thank you. My
support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to a generous gift from Robert and Alice Campbell. That's it for us. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today, in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be a nature writer and a beekeeper. Her name, Susan Brackney. She is the author of Plan B, everything you wanted to know about the hardest working creatures on the planet. We'll talk about the honeybee this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, May wheat trading at 6.29¾, up 2¾. July, 6.27¾, down 5¼. Chicago May wheat 580, down 1/2. July 585½, down 5½. May corn 412½, down 1½. July 420, down 1. September 428½, down 1. December 439, down 3/4. May soybeans 11.30¾, down 3¼. July 11.08, down 3½. August 10.68, down 5½. September 10.15¾, down 5¾. November 9.74½, down 5. May meal 362.10, that's